Lecture 4, Principles of Natural Law Theory.
In subsequent lectures, we will begin to consider the long history of natural law and to see how this tremendously interesting but complicated theory came to develop. But I'd like to devote one more preliminary lecture here to an extremely important concept which in a way makes all the rest as significant as they are, namely that notion of the human person. Because natural law, if it's grounded upon anything, is grounded upon an understanding of the human person. In technical philosophy, we call this philosophical anthropology, that is, the effort to deal with the humankind and to deal with it precisely as person. What we had established, I think, through the end of the last lecture was a strong sense of human nature. And so today what I'd like to do, after briefly reviewing that point about human nature, is to go on to ask the question about human person. And then, after we've talked about human person, I'd like to make a few last preliminary notes about moral knowledge and about the form that natural law theory will take as the result of all of this. First, however, the questions of philosophical anthropology. What we were saying was that natural law depends upon there being such a thing as a natural kind, namely the humankind, distinguishable from other sorts of animals. As such, the natural kind, that is, human nature, is defined as rational animal, a kind of animal, and therefore having all sorts of things appropriate to animals, a material body, life, the capacity for nutrition, an ability to grow, to reproduce, locomotion, being able to walk around, sensory activity, and so on. All the things that we associate with biological life. In all of these respects, natural kind, that is, human nature, shows not just a static completeness to these things, but shows a pattern of development. And one of the things that is so crucial to our understanding of human nature for the purposes of natural law theory is an appreciation not only of the normal case when we have an adult that's healthy and mature, we call that the privilege of the normal case, but also a strong sense of the development by which that particular mature, healthy adult case comes about. And that this pattern of development is as important to natural law theory and to human nature as the finished product. Strong sense that development is crucial, and that the pattern of development that flows out of the nature is deeply and intrinsically objective, is something that an open-minded person can be brought to see upon sufficient observation and sufficient reflection. I think that this will begin to answer the kind of questions that are raised when immediately objections come to our mind. How about those individual human beings like autistic children or like the senile, the aged? If they are unable to manifest all of the activities and the typical operations of the healthy, normal, privileged, mature case, do they still count? Are they still a member of this protected species? And this is why we need to consider not only the question of human nature in its animality and in its rationality, but why we also need to consider the question of person. Because person is a moral category. Person refers to what deserves certain kind of protection by virtue of having an intrinsic dignity and therefore certain kinds of human rights. And likewise, person is what is able to be held accountable by virtue of any actions, by virtue of choices made. There's a moral responsibility that comes by our exercise of the powers of rationality, by the kind of things that we knowingly choose to do. So the question comes, are all persons human, and are all humans persons? I ask both those questions because the category, as we use it in ordinary speech, seems to be that all humans are persons and all persons are human. But if we reflect a little bit more, we see that there is a very strong and interesting and somewhat controversial claim being made here. First, are all persons human? Well, as a matter of fact, those who are religious believers think of God as personal, and yet God is certainly not human. And likewise, if your own particular religious stance includes a belief in angels, we have other personal beings who are in no way human. So I would want to say, for my own purposes here, that the category person is actually larger than the category of human. There are persons who are not human persons, but divine or angelic ones. On the other hand, those who do not believe in God or do not believe in angels will find that the question still pertains, presumably, all human beings then are persons. But that, too, is a controversial question. Namely, if we define human being in a structural way, I think we will say that all human beings are persons. But those who would prefer to exclude certain categories of those who are human biologically, sometimes people want to exclude the unborn, or exclude the deformed children, or exclude the deficient aged, or to exclude the senile, they will be trying to say that not all human beings are persons, but that personhood is restricted to function, the capacity to exhibit this rationality. I think that that is a fundamental moral mistake that cannot carry the day because it is subjective rather than objective. That is, it is based on an arbitrary distinction rather than based on an objective distinction. But I regard that as the burden of proof. This is what has to be established in order to make the claims I'm going to make. Now, in order to consider the question, I'd like to suggest that we make a bit of an historical detour. The very origins of the notion of person have an interesting history. The classic definition of a person is provided by a 6th century Roman jurist by the name of Boethius. And his definition for person goes like this. A person is an individual substance of a rational nature. He articulated that definition not because so much of human moral questions, but he articulated it for theological reasons. That is, he was concerned with some of the theological questions that had originated about Christian religious claims. We have, for instance, the claim in Christianity that there are three something or others in one God. And likewise, in the being that is Jesus Christ, the Christian church makes the claim that there are human and divine aspects of this one single individual. But in Boethius's time, there was no reliable term available for talking about the three whos in one what, or talking about the two whats in one who. Rather, there was a need for the development of terminology. In Greek and Roman philosophy up until that point, the philosophy of Aristotle and Plato, the philosophy of Socrates and the Stoics, there was a tremendous development of terminology. Being, for instance, refers to everything which exists. Individual refers to unique entities, that is, unified entities. Nature refers to the kind of thing that a thing is. But there was no such term as person. In Greek, for instance, there are plenty of terms for God and the various gods. There are plenty of terms for angelic intelligences. There are terms that take in all human beings. Our word anthropology comes from a word anthropos, which means human being. There are terms for male and female human beings. But there's no word that gets gods, angels, and all human beings as rational beings under one collective term. Even though we say the Greeks had a word for it, turns out they didn't have a word for this one. But there were terms available which thinkers like Boethius and others of his own time found and provided a little philosophical development for so that they could capture this notion of rationality in a unified substance. The term that we use, persona, is a Latin origin of the word person. The Greek word is prosopon. Let's stick with the word in Latin, but it means the same thing as the word in Greek, persona. It's a word that has theatrical origins. You remember, of course, in ancient theater that they were tremendously dependent upon masks. And the mask served both to indicate who the character was, as well as to serve as a kind of a microphone, a certain loudspeaker for the theatrical community. The word person comes from persona, which means to sound through. And it initially refers to just the mask that the actor is wearing. But then, in addition to referring to the mask, it can refer to the role that the actor is playing. In, for instance, classical Greek theater of Aeschylus or of Sophocles, there are just two actors plus a chorus. If there are more characters in the play, it's done by using different masks. Eventually, Sophocles introduces a third actor. Euripides and Aristophanes follow suit, and their plays get much more complicated, and the plots get much more delightful, precisely because they've got more actors available to play more parts simultaneously. But the term person, at the time prior to Boethius, simply refers to the mask or the role that is being played, and only comes by virtue of work of people like Boethius to refer to the human individual who is playing the role and serving as a character. That is, there's gradually a giving of philosophical weight to a term that is primarily theatrical. The term persona in Latin also refers to grammar. When we talk about I as first person, you as second person, he, she, or it as third person, it has a grammatical sense. Likewise, it has a legal sense, the sort of thing we've seen in this country when sometimes the court had to consider whether railroads were corporate personalities. So, too, in Roman law, persona can refer to a corporate personality. But to get the notion to refer not to a railroad or a forest as a person, but to find a term that could include intelligence and rationality and will, like God or angels or human beings, but not animals, however sophisticated, there was need for this philosophical progress, and the term person was made to bear that load. Let's consider some of the parts of Boethius' definition, and we'll see so much of what's important in the subsequent history of the term person, so that it eventually comes to have the things that you and I associate with personality, personal consciousness, center of personal identity, and especially for moral purposes, the bearer of moral rights and responsibilities. Boethius says that person is an individual substance of a rational nature. Individual is a relatively clear term. We mean it not in some radically atomistic sense of being absolutely isolated from others, but rather some recognizable unity. That an individual, and we can have individual trees in a forest, we can have individual cats in a group of cats we're trying to herd, we can have individual atoms, and we can have individual protons and individual electrons. But for some things in this world, individuals are harder to come by. We don't think of water, for instance, as an individual. Oh, we can get it down to an individual atom of H2O, and yet the individual atom, if we could have just that separated by itself, that molecule would not have many of the properties of water. You need lots of them around in order for water to be acting and having the properties of water. We can have individual pails of water or individual gallons of water, but as such, we have artificially introduced the distinction, putting all the water here or putting all the water there. Whereas with an individual cat or an individual tree or an individual human being, the individual is clearly what it is precisely by being an internally unified being which can move around separately from some other. The term that Boethius adds to the definition to try to bring this out is the term substance. And substance is a word which to us, I think, suggests different chemicals. We say, what kind of substance is that? And we think it's gold or we think it's silver. But substance names the being of a thing according to a certain kind. And so when we're referring to an individual, we say that individual always has some particular kind of nature. You can see how his definition is unfolding. An individual substance of a rational nature. So the key element here will be to identify the properties and the traits and the powers which make possible the identification of this individual substance according to a specific nature, namely rationality. We have here taken the privileged case, whether it be a god operating as a god should, an angelic intelligence operating the way angels do, or a human being in the full, mature, healthy, normal sense, showing and exhibiting that rationality. But where God is God eternally, and where angels seem to be always angelic and never have a process of development, they don't grow up from being little angels to being big angels, humans have a process of development. And hence, the term person is designed to identify that type of being which we are, which is so different from all the rest of the animal creation, and is capable of making us similar to gods and angels, namely having rationality and having a kind of uniqueness by virtue of that rationality. Now, even the uniqueness has to be understood carefully. Maybe you have your pet rock, or maybe you have your favorite tree, and they are certainly unique trees which have grown just that way, or rocks which have been formed in just the way that they have been formed. And yet their uniqueness is of a relatively static kind. It's this rock rather than that. It's this tree rather than that. It belongs to you or belongs to me. But their uniqueness is largely in terms of something else, my ownership, or their position in space. Their uniqueness isn't particularly anything special. It isn't anything of a moral dimension. Whereas what we mean by the human person is a uniqueness that comes not just from being an individual of the human nature, but is a uniqueness that comes by virtue of the personal histories that we ourselves bear responsibility for working out. That over the course of the time that we live and that we develop, we start to have such unique personalities. I love chatting with my friends who have young children and asking them, you probably ask the same sort of question, do your children have their own personality? And my friends, my young friends, insist that even from the time of them being slight and small babies, you can start to see their very individuating characteristics, which makes them quite irreplaceably unique. Characteristics which were already starting to develop in the womb, and scientists have done amazing studies with respect to how even the unborn are able to hear some of the strains, say, of classical music or the strains of rock music, and that their moods are also altered by what they're hearing, even though it isn't yet at the point of understanding, it's more at the level of some emotional impact. They've done long-term studies with respect to how emotions develop in the course of those sort of long-term perspectives and the experience that children have over the course of their lives. Their uniqueness comes partly as a result of nature, what their genetic structures are, partly as a result of nurture, how they are treated, but also, and equally important, our uniqueness is a function of our rational choices, of starting to know at the very early levels what the options are and starting to choose. One sees in the smallest children signs of willfulness, and I can't help but think of that wonderful story of Augustine when he's thinking about his own infancy, but reflecting upon some of the traits he sees in other instances. And he tells the charming story at one point of two children, one at his mother's breast, the other at his mother's knee. And he notes how utterly jealous the one at the knee is. Even though he's well-fed, quite full, he's jealous and would murder the other little kid simply because the other is getting attention. There's that willfulness, and he's starting to show a sign of what sort of a child he will be and needs to be carefully dealt with, so that there is real love and attention that is given, even though he has to learn that he's not the center of the world and that he can't always have all the attention. Our unique personalities begin at a stage before we're in total rational control, but emerge more and more as the powers of our rationality come into place. One sees, then, if I may summarize, the importance of Boethius's definition for all human persons. One also sees, if one does studies in neonatology and in embryology, that the efforts to try to define some human beings as non-persons invariably fail. They try to articulate demarcation points, after which some particular function is now available. And yet, there has been no radical change. There is still the same DNA structure. There is still the same genetic composition. There is still the same continuity of biological existence. The creature has not changed its nature. Rather, we have fundamentally and entirely the same type of being, the same nature, even though the personal characteristics only start showing up later in the course of the development. In addition to considerations of individual personality, it's also important for natural law to realize the social dimension of our personality, namely, that we're not atomistic units, not when we're full-blown, not when we're tiny. We are always relational beings. We're beings which are social. In fact, Aristotle's other preferred definition for humankind is not just rational animal, but social animal, or sometimes he says political animal. And by that, I think he means to suggest we are, by our very natures, whether you're a Greek like Aristotle who thinks that human nature is an eternal thing, or whether you're a religious person who thinks of us as truly created by God, we are either by our natures eternally or created to have these natures by our Creator with natures that are social. And the sociality goes in various levels. It starts at the most immediate level of the family and extends outward to various forms of association, some of them merely geographic, tribal, others of them of a voluntary nature, the groups that we join, and extending eventually as far as states or even international organizations. If one is extremely cosmopolitan, one may think of oneself as a citizen of the world or a citizen of the universe. But all of these levels of sociality are things that we need. Granted, highly granted, the forms that sociality take can vary enormously. And yet, there is a human need for social organization. Think of the various kinds of families that you know. There are very tiny families in which there are only spouses, perhaps one child or two. There are families which are much, much larger. And then there's those families when they have family reunions that have hundreds coming. You need a map in order to understand the whole thing. But the ways in which families may exist, living just in very tight nuclear families, whether existing in much larger groups, nonetheless share certain bonds. They make certain things possible, and there are patterns of dependence that are observable by sociologists. Likewise, the forms of social organization for which we voluntarily accede are enormously varied. There will be some societies that will be organized according to work groups. There will be some societies that allow for political organization. There will be some societies that really do foster the notions of teams and sports or groups in which we have our fun. There will be some political organizations that are focused largely on the territory you can unite within one city. And there will be forms of social organization that transcend vast distances, such as our own country does, where we have virtually annihilated distance precisely by the forms of our communication. But whatever these forms take, there is still a natural need for it. And what natural law is emphasizing in reflecting upon persons is our tremendous need for this socialization, our utter inability to do without it, even though there is a tremendous flexibility with the precise form this social organization takes. A natural lawyer, worth his salt, always has to remember that there are certain things that natural law can figure out and certain things that a natural law analysis alone cannot determine. Part of what natural law requires is a patience for looking at the history of a culture and looking at the history of a society and looking at the history of a family and even looking at the history of an individual. You can't determine everything in advance, but often you have to use the reflection upon the history. What really did work in order to foster human development? And what really frustrated human development? It may have seemed good at the time. It might have seemed enormously pleasant. There might have been a tremendous instinctual attraction to it. But somehow it undermined the kind of development that was necessary for real maturity. And there are other things which don't seem promising. In a way, the discipline always seems hard and forbidding. And yet those social disciplines or those family disciplines may be just what we need for our full development as persons. One can see this not only in the Thomism that I've been trying to present to you so far, but one can see this in very different theories, just for the sake of an example and to show that this is not simply a position held only by one point of view, but by a position that very much differs with it on many other important moral points. Let me switch over for a moment to Freudian theory. One of the Freudian psychologists that I have found most helpful in the course of my own readings in that subject is a British Freudian psychologist by the name of Elizabeth Moberly. And in her books, she is very much interested in talking about the ways in which human beings depend upon one another for learning how to love and to be loved. And she stresses the necessity of social organization and family structure for the sake of true human personal development, and she shows the tremendous traumas and difficulties that come when something is injured, especially early on in the periods when a child is under tremendous influence of those who are around it. In the book Psychogenesis, Elizabeth Moberly discusses the traumas that can afflict a person when either one's mother or one's father is not acting in ways that are helpful to human development. She stresses that every little boy needs to learn how to relate to his father and to his mother for everything that that child will subsequently do with respect to dealing with men and dealing with women. That there's something about the way in which one gives love to one's father and receives loves from one's father that will be very helpful. It won't absolutely determine, but will be of enormous influence with respect to how that boy deals with men subsequently in his life. Likewise, there will be something about how a boy deals with his mother, how he gives loves to her and receives love from her, that will be of enormous influence with respect to how he deals with women in all the rest of his life. Perhaps you've noticed that sometimes a man will tend to marry somebody who's very much like his mother. Sometimes it's because of the overemphasis upon one aspect of this, or sometimes because of the underemphasis, that all one's life one feels the need to try to repair some damage that was done early on. Similarly, a little girl has the same sorts of relationships, but differently from her point of view. She learns to give and receive love to other women on the basis of the way in which she has related to her mother, and she learns how to deal with the men who will subsequently be in her life, with very much influence based on how she has given and received love from her father. Again, I repeat, I'm not a card-carrying Freudian, nor do I mean to suggest that this explains everything about psychopathology that takes place later in life. I don't think that. I don't think that the Freudians think that. The claim, rather, is that our family structures are of enormous natural significance in providing us some of the stability, in providing us some of the stimulation, in providing some of the challenge, in eliciting from us and drawing out from us some of those things that can't ever be learned in so many words, or at least not learned except without a tremendous amount of trouble, but rather are learned by us even in our smallest period by the ways in which our family society has been organized. I think one could do the same kind of reflection upon the ways in which different political organizations manage to bring out different virtues. A democratic culture, for instance, insists that its people learn various things and learn to discuss and to debate things without rancor, that one has to learn how to act in the public forum and state a position clearly and then stand up by what one does for the position that one has taken, that one will be called to account both for one's reasoning and one will be account for one's life, and one will be expected to show that life in by one's example. This would be true of a democratic culture such as our own in ways that would not be true of, for instance, certain types of aristocratic culture. In certain types of aristocratic culture, where, for instance, there is an aristocracy and a nobility or a king, the nobles are expected to act nobly, but one has the sense that the vast majority of the population may not be capable of such noble activity, will never have an explicit participation in politics. And the social culture is enormously affected by the type of regime. My sense, then, is that natural law theory is enormously alert to the fact that we need various kinds of help from one another by the forms of social organization that we have, and that differences in this may be quite tolerable. That is not just one type of political association or just one type of family, but there is a range of permissible options, permissible largely in terms of the subsequent history, the form of family or the form of voluntary association or the form of governmental culture will allow persons to develop relatively well. There will be some cultures which inculcate habits or blindnesses, which will be, in fact, destructive. I think, for example, of cultures which practiced human sacrifice. And what they are saying about the worth of an individual speaks volumes precisely by that form of culture. Slaveholding cultures now may seem extremely alien to us, and yet it is not that far back in our American history when somehow there was a cultural blindness in this respect. Moral knowledge in this matter is something that comes about first by way of inclination. We look at how human beings are inclined to act. And yet our inclinations themselves do not give us perfect knowledge of any of these things. The inclinations that we feel toward a good or revulsed from some evil, from some pain, always need to be submitted to rational reflection, the individual reflecting on his or her own experience, the community reflecting on the experience, and letting those who are wise, letting those who have more experience, greater powers of articulation, greater powers of comparison, begin to philosophize about this so as to recommend patterns of association, patterns of dependence, patterns of development and maturation that lead to real human fulfillment and that avoid the patterns of disintegration. In the next hour, we'll be turning to questions of history and learning how some of these ideas came to be discovered in the course of philosophical history.